Okay, so if everyone can get it out, we'll just start with a quick overview of where we're up to. So, does anyone remember what happened last week? Tim gave us the talk last week, and what did we discuss? Just ballparks, characters. Mawad?
Ma, the guy that seduces her half sister, brother. Sorry.
Very good. So what's happened is David, in 1 Samuel and part of 2 Samuel, David's going through a honeymoon with God. Okay, he's had this wonderful period with God where he's on cloud nine and they're romanticizing, they're complimenting each other, him and God. He's talking to God face to face. He's having a beautiful time. He's doing nothing wrong or very little wrong. And then, of course, he must get lax or something happens. Okay, maybe for a long period of time, maybe for a short period of time, and he does a major sin, okay? Not just, like, it's a huge sin. He sleeps with someone else, he steals someone's wife, he has total disregard for human life, he kills the guy, he kills him by his own hand, you know, so he gives him the letter in his own hand. Even Joab's upset with him, God's upset with him, everyone's upset with David, okay? Because what he did was really bad, okay? But he's immediately forgiven, right? Because he's immediately repentant, okay? And he immediately says, I've sinned against the Lord. Not against Uriah, not against Bathsheba, not against anyone else. I've sinned against the Lord. And he's forgiven in an instant. And then he fasts, asking for the life of his child. Of course, God doesn't give him the life of that child, but he gives him another child from the same lady, okay? Basically saying to him that, I've answered your prayer. In spite of your sin, I will answer your prayer and give you Solomon out of Bathsheba. Okay? So he's given Solomon, who probably is a comfort to him in the next few chapters when he's going through all the terror that happens in his life in the next few chapters. Yeah.
You know how you said he's instantly forgiven? Isn't like his punishment like almost changed? Like he's still punished. Like how God says the house, the sword won't ever leave the house. He's still, I don't know.
He's forgiven, yes. Like we said last week, he's forgiven. His sin is taken away, but there is a consequence to his sin. Likely that consequence is not necessarily a punishment from God. That consequence is, like we said last week, more than likely that he had a number of years where he was far away from God, or lax, or immoral, or something. Because he didn't just commit this sin out of nowhere. Okay, that's what we mentioned last week, is that you're not going to get someone who's that holy, who's going to collapse that quickly. He will get into pride. He will become complacent with his spiritual life, think he's beyond certain sins, like adultery, like lusting after other women, like stealing other people's wives, like murder, like something. I mean, you think, and all of us are the same. When we think there's certain sins I'm capable of doing, and certain sins I'm not capable of doing. For example, the love of money. When I was younger, I never thought that the love of money could enter into my heart because I just didn't care. I was young. The second you start making money, that enters into your heart. Okay, same with lusting after other women and the whole cheating and murdering. You don't think that form of hate can enter you until you're there. Okay, and unless you're diligent against these things, anything can happen to anyone. And that's what happened to David. David, I'm sure, thought he was beyond all this stuff because he was, like, looking at his story, the guy was an inspiration, you know. I mean, I always like to say about him, there's no point commenting on David's life prior to this point because just reading it is enough. You know, reading it is enough. You're just inspired by just reading him, you know. Look at the way he responds. Look at how humble he is. Look at, you know, the way he deals with everything. And then suddenly he does something that's shocking. And then he's told that you're going to lose this son, which he does, but God gives him another in his place. And he's told that the sword will not leave your house. Okay, so what happens is after that point, we read about the story of Amnon, his eldest son, raping his half-sister, okay, and then kicking her out, so disgracing her as well, okay? Then Absalom, her full brother, so is everyone clear on the halves and the fools? So Absalom, the full brother, is angry and decides he wants to get revenge. 2 years later, in cold, premeditated murder, he kills Amnon only, in cold blood. Okay, now of course, if you're reading all this, who's the biggest victim in all this is David. Anyone, I mean, most of you here don't have kids, but anyone, when you have kids, you'll realize that the most hurtful thing that can happen to you is what's happening to David. One, your daughter gets raped. The fear of any father with a daughter. Okay? Two, that your son is the one who rapes your daughter. Okay? Three, that your other son hates his brother and kills him. There's nothing worse for a father. There can be nothing worse. Anything else could have happened to David wouldn't have been as bad as this. Okay? So he's really suffering for what he's done. Okay? And he's the biggest victim. Of course, there's other victims. I mean, Tamar's been hard done by. I mean, there's other victims here. But David's the biggest victim. All right? And just another quick piece of background that is just going to be relevant to today is Joab. So Joab is the commander of David's army. And just to put just a very small bit of context for him, he's got two brothers. Does anyone know their names? One of them died. Okay, Abishai and Asahel. They're the two brothers. The one that was a fast runner, I think, is Asahel. Got killed by Abner, who was the commander of Saul's army. Okay, just to put some context, because that's going to come in later. And of course, David is very upset that and Joab seeks vengeance on Abner, the commander of Saul's army, by killing him. And David, that day, is really upset with Joab. And he publicly says, that was not me, it was him. This blood is not on my hands, it's on Joab's hands. Okay? I had nothing to do with it, I accepted Abner. Because he said Abner was an honorable man. Okay, so then we get to chapter 14. So that's what we're going to read today. Okay, so there's four main characters that we're going to meet in today's chapter. And we'll go through three of them as different stages of living. There's those who live for themselves, there's those who live for the people around them, and there's those who live for God. Okay? And once we've talked about those three, then we'll talk about Absalom just a little bit as well, because we finished the chapter with Absalom. Okay, so let's read chapter 14, verses 1 to 3. Start with Chris.
So Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was concerned about Absalom. And Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, "Please pretend to be a mourner and put on a mourning apparel. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but act like a woman who has been mourning a long time for the dead. Go to the king and speak to him in his manner." So Joab put the words in her mouth.
Okay, so the first three verses is Joab saying, look, let's get this wise woman from this place called Tekoa, and let's get her to go. Oh, sorry. So Absalom, after he kills Amnon, flees from the presence of David because he's committed murder. For him to commit murder, the sentence on him is murder, is death. And so, and the person who's supposed to seek vengeance and justice on Absalom is David, okay? Because he's next of kin and he's the king. So there's two reasons why he's the one that's supposed to get Absalom. Okay, so Absalom flees. Now, David is of course very upset by all this, okay? Because that's his son. In spite of the fact that he's done this horrible thing, it's still his son, and he's miserable about it. And then Joab, he sees that David's upset, and he says, look, let's get this lady, and we're going to get her to convince David to bring Absalom back. And they set up this tale for him. Okay, so what do you think are Joab's motivations here? Okay, so can anyone tell me what you think Joab's motivation is here? Is it a love for Absalom? Is it a love for David? What is it?
It's definitely not for David.
Okay.
Because he's asking her to pretend.
Yeah?
For himself.
Do you want to explain?
Is it for David? Because he goes that Absalom, Joab said that the king's heart was concerned about Absalom, so it's not this wise woman.
Yeah, so I mean, one place I was reading, they say they don't comment on Joab's motivations here, but they leave it up to the reader to decide, okay? And then you go and read people like Abuna Tadros, Matthew Henry, and they all unanimously agree that Joab was after his own self-interest. For multiple reasons. Some wise reasons. I mean, some were just political. I mean, that just made sense. For example, one, he saw David was upset. The king's upset, you got to make the king happy. Okay? So that was one reason. He just wanted to make the king happy. Okay? Two, if he's the one that affects the reconciliation between Absalom and David, because he Abuna Tadros says about him that he knows that David is eventually going to reconcile with Absalom. Okay? It's the nature of David. So if he knows he's eventually going to reconcile with Absalom, I might as well be the guy that affects it. I get favor with both of them. 3, if Absalom eventually... Say David dies while Absalom's in exile. Okay, people love Absalom. People might want to make Absalom king. If that's the case, and it's still seen that David hates Absalom, then there's going to be a civil war. Okay? So Absalom, I mean, Joab might be foreseeing this and thinking, let's resolve the situation now. The fourth thing is that thing that I was telling you about earlier, that Joab killed Abner, and he knows David was upset with him about that. And this, according to some people, is his way of reconciling with David. Saying, look, yes, I killed that guy. Yes, I know you're upset with me. But if you can forgive Absalom, you can forgive me. Okay? And so he's trying to reconcile himself with David. Okay, so if we just skip... and so it's generally perceived that he's just after his own self-interest. And so if we just read quickly, just skip a few verses and read verses 21 to 22...
And the king said to Joab, "All right, I have granted this thing. Go therefore and bring back the young man Absalom." Then Joab fell to the ground on his face and bowed himself and thanked the king. And Joab said, "Today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord, O king, in that the king has fulfilled the request of his servant."
Okay. So he's saying to him, "Oh, look, now I've found favor in your sight." And a lot of people read this to say that he previously was not in David's favor because of that incident with Abner. So he's just reconciling himself. So just after selfish ambition. Okay? And so just quickly on the relationship between Joab and David. The reason why a lot of people think this about Joab is because if you read his story from beginning to end, he comes up a lot. Okay? And he seems to always be after his own self-interest. I mean, he has a very interesting relationship with David, which I'll let you guys decide about. But he's constantly at loggerheads with David. He's always arguing with him. Twice David tries to get rid of Joab because he's too violent for him. Twice. He says, look, I can't, like, I'm putting someone else. He puts Abner in his place. Joab kills Abner. Then he later on, Absalom's chief of the army, his name's Amasa. David puts him in his place. Joab kills him. In a few chapters, you'll read that, and another thing that makes you realize Joab didn't actually love Absalom and just love him and want to bring him back is that the person who killed Absalom is who? Joab. Okay, Joab is the one who kills Absalom. Okay? Yes, it's in a war, but he does end up killing him and he has no guilty feeling about it whatsoever, has no remorse, whereas David's really upset about it. So he kills all these people. Okay? Anyone that stands in his way, okay, he kills them. At times, he seems like he's full of wisdom. One, he wants Absalom to come back. He realizes that that might create peace. Two, after Absalom dies, David gets really upset. Okay, even though he wins the war, David gets really upset. And he turns the victory into mourning. And the whole crowd is upset and they don't know how to react. Okay, because their king is upset. And then Joab comes to him and tells him off. Okay. Now you think to yourself, how does Joab get away with telling off David? And he does. And David listens to Joab. Thirdly, later, much later on, David commits another sin. Okay, he only really commits two major sins. And he gets punished badly for both of them. Does anyone remember what his second sin is?
The census,
yes. At the end of 2 Samuel, he decides to count the people. He's built his kingdom. He thinks he's great. I've created a great nation. Let's count to see how many people live here. How many people are under my authority. Okay? And then Joab, as David says, let's count them. Joab says to him, don't count the people. Are you sure you want to do this? And David goes, I'm going to do it. And he did it, and he got punished badly, which we'll read about later. Okay? And so you read about this Joab character, and you think to yourself, he's not all bad. I mean, he seems to understand the will of God sometimes. But sometimes he doesn't. And what's the final outcome of Joab? Does anyone remember?
David asked Saul to kill him.
Not Saul, Solomon. Yeah. So has anyone seen that scene in The Godfather? Where there's this great scene where Marlon Brando is about to hand over reins as The Godfather. And he gives it to Al Pacino. I can't remember the names in the movie. And he sits down with him and says, look, there's this guy. He did me wrong. You need to kill him. There's this guy, he's going to cause you trouble, you've got to kill him. And so he pretty much paves the way for Al Pacino to become the godfather. All right, it's a really crazy scene. And then Al Pacino does it. Right? It's really like sort of gory scene. They kill everyone. And David does the same thing with Solomon. He sits down with him and says, "This guy offended me in my time. Don't let him go down in peace. Joab, you saw what he did to Abner and Amasa. Kill him. Don't let him go down in peace." So what's the final verdict on Joab? The final verdict on Joab is that he lived for himself. He never really cared about anyone else. Yes, he might have had a bit of wisdom about him. He had a logical mind. He was next to David all his life, so he understood a little bit about the nature of God, maybe, in an academic way. But he didn't ever act for the interests of God or for anyone else. He acted for himself. So the final outcome for him was a violent death. Okay? And he gets killed. He gets slain. Okay? And that's the first way of living. There's three ways of living that the three people are going to encounter. And one of them is to live for yourself. And that's the way a lot of people live these days. You know, I sit at work sometimes and you get patients coming in and they tell you stories about their lives. And the selfish decisions that they make, they just don't care about the consequences. For example, they'll say, like I heard a story about a lady, she came in the other day and she said she was a bit overweight. She was married to a guy, had a perfect relationship. She had a personal trainer. She lost a lot of weight. She started to look good. She started to get attention. First thing she does is go and cheat with her personal trainer. Okay? Now, what's the consequence of that? There's a husband there that's now losing his wife. Her father, who stopped drinking, who was an alcoholic, stopped drinking, because of this, started drinking again. Of course, all she can think about is her immediate happiness. She's living for herself in that moment. Okay? And you hear about stories like this day in, day out. You read the news, and all you hear about is stories about people. All they care about is themselves. And of course, that's the best way to make society collapse, to make everyone around you miserable, to spread sin around to everyone around you. Unfortunately, a lot of us, that's how we live. You live for yourself. All you really think about is my immediate environment and what I want. And we'll see in a minute that even if often you live for others, often you only live for yourself. So even if there is a time when you live for others, there is majority of time that you live for yourself. And the ultimate outcome for you is condemnation. There's no other solution. Even if you're inherently a good person, in my nature I'm good, that's how I was born. Even if, before God, the final outcome for you is condemnation. Just like with Joab. Even if you have wisdom about you, even if you make good decisions in your life, the final outcome is condemnation. Okay? That's one way to live. The second person we'll talk about is the wise woman of Tekoa. So, let's read verses 4 to 12. Danny.
And when the woman of Tekoa spoke to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and prostrated herself and said, "Help, O king." Then the king said to her, "What troubles you?" And she answered, "Indeed, I am a widow. My husband is dead. Now your maidservant had two sons, and the two fought with each other in the field. And there was no one to part them. But the one struck the other and killed him. And now the whole family has risen up against your maidservant. And they said, 'Deliver him who struck his brother, that we may execute him for the life of his brother, whom he killed. And we will destroy the hair so also, so they would extinguish my ember that is left, and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the earth. Then the king said to the woman, "Go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you." And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, "My lord, O king, let the iniquity be on me, and on my father's house, and the king and his throne be guiltless." So the king said, "Whoever says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall not touch you anymore." Then she said, Please let the king remember the Lord your God, and do not permit the avenge of blood to destroy anymore, lest they destroy my son." And he said, "As the Lord lives, no one hair of your sons shall fall on the ground."
Okay. And did I ask you to read 12 as well?
Yep.
No, that's all right. Yep. Absolutely, that's fine. Okay, so Joab devises this plan with this wise woman of Tekoa and says, "Go and tell the king this story about one of your sons killed the other son, and if, and now because of that, this son deserves to die. And the rest of the family wants this son to die. And in fact, he justifiably should die. Okay? But if we kill him, I lose my husband's inheritance. His name on the earth is gone. Have compassion on me. And she appeals to David's compassion. And then they have this interesting dialogue. Then the king said, go to your house and I will give orders concerning you. And then they kind of go back and forth 2-3 times. And then they finally conclude that, fine, I will pardon your son. Okay? And that's the story. Okay? And that's this woman of Tekoa. Okay? Now, just a quick few points about how clever this ploy was. First of all, Joab and this woman, they came up with this plan. And part of the plan was, they're not 100% sure it's going to go right. I mean, they're pretty sure because of the nature of David. Okay? They understand his character a little bit. But they're not 100% sure. So basically, I mean, one Matthew Henry comments that if David, during this story, says, too bad, he's got to die, they'll just pull out. Okay, no worries. All right? Okay, and they just leave and let the guy die. All right? And no harm done. But if he says, oh, he should be freed, I'll free him, then they can turn on him and say, no, then you should bring Absalom back. Okay? So it's a clever little plan. Or you wonder as well, the other thing that you wonder, just from that little contemplation from Matthew Henry, is that if he did decide that person deserves to die, if Joab, being sly as he was, because he was a little bit sly, if he would have then turned and said, then Absalom should die. Because maybe he would have then turned on Absalom and said, maybe he should die. You wonder. I mean, that's just a contemplation, but you wonder. Matthew Henry comments on this woman that she's a wise woman. And he says that it's Joab's plan. All she has to do is execute it. But she's very quick-witted in the way she does it, the way she carries it out. I mean, one other thing I was reading, they were saying that this place, Tekoa, may have been a source of wisdom. Like, everyone there was known for their wisdom. But she still would have had to be really quick-witted in the way she interacted with David. And you'll see, as we read the story a little bit, that she tub-tubs ala David, and she tub-tubs ala Joab, and she tub-tubs ala everyone. She's actually a very wise woman. And then she makes David almost repeat himself 3 times. Does anyone really know why she kind of fleshes it out 3 times?
To emphasize her point.
To emphasize, yeah. But there's a different answer each time as well. basically, I mean, what some people say is that the first time he responds, he says, go to your house and I'll give orders concerning you. So he hasn't actually said the kid is pardoned. He's just said that I'm going to look into your case, okay? And then looking into the case means that if David finds in favor of this kid, then the person who's supposed to exact judgment incurs judgment. And that's why she responds and says, my lord, O king, let the iniquity be on me, on my father's house, and the king and his throne shall be guiltless. So he's saying, even if you do agree to pardon my kid, put the guilt on me, not on yourself. So she's just trying to pave a way to get David to say yes. And then he responds saying, all right, fine, I'll look into your case. And if anyone says anything even against you, we're not going to let them hurt you. Okay? But he hasn't yet given orders concerning the kid. And then she says, please let the king remember the Lord your God and do not permit the avenger of blood to destroy any more, lest they destroy my son. And then he says, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. So he gives a full pardon. He gives a full pardon. Now let's read. So he's given full pardon now. So the lady has pardon for her son. Let's read from verse 13 to 20 about her response and David's response. Johnny. From verse 12, sorry.
Therefore the woman said, please let your maidservant speak another word to my lord the king. And he said, say on. So the woman said, why then have you schemed such a thing against the people of God? For the king speaks this thing as one who is guilty, in that the king does not bring his banished one home again. For we will surely die and become like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Yet God does not take away a life, but he devises means, so that his banished ones are not expelled from him. Now therefore I have come to speak of this thing to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid. And your maidservant said, I will now speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his maidservant. For the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the inheritance of God. Your maidservant said, the word of my lord the king will now be comforting. For as the angel of God, so is my lord the king in discerning good and evil. And may the Lord your God be with you. Then the king answered and said to the woman, please do not hide from me anything that I ask you. And the woman said, please let my lord the king speak. So the king said, is the hand of Joab with you in all this? And the woman answered and said, as you live, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right hand or to the left from anything that my lord the king has spoken. For your servant Joab commanded me, and he put all these words in the mouth of your maidservant. To bring about this change of affairs, your servant Joab has done this thing. But my lord is wise according to the wisdom of the angel of God to know everything that is in the earth.
Okay, so basically she says, all right, you pardon the kid. Now why aren't you pardoning Absalom? Okay, and she turns it on its head. And David, of course, so it must be pointed out at this point, what Absalom did is very different to what this kid did. It's very different. Okay, so this kid committed an act of murder in hot blood. Okay, he was provoked by his brother and killed him, according to the story that she made up. Absalom did it in premeditated murder, in cold blood. Okay, so it's different. Okay, the other thing is Absalom is not the sole heir to the kingdom. David does not lose his line. He does not lose the line to the kingdom if he loses Absalom. There's many brothers he has in his place. In fact, David wants, or maybe at this point he does or he doesn't, we're not sure, but he wants Solomon to be king. So it's very different. Okay, so it's a very different story. However, David is just happy that he has an excuse to bring Absalom back. He wants to bring Absalom back. So the story is very different. Absalom made a big public spectacle of his murder as well. He didn't do it quietly. He brought all the brothers over and he killed him in front of everyone. Okay, and he made a big scene about it. So it's very different. That's one thing we need to keep an eye on. Yep.
Like, wasn't David, like, not unhappy with Absalom? Because it says that he longed to go to Absalom for being comforted concerning Amnon.
Yeah, he was.
He was okay with Absalom. Like,
he's his father. Yeah. He's upset by what he's done, but at the same time, he longs for him.
And it says he's comforted concerning Amnon because he was dead. So he was happy that... Wasn't he happy that Amnon was dead? Like,
not necessarily. I think he derived comfort by the fact that it's over. Yeah. It's finished. And now let me just have my son back, the one that's alive, let me have him back. It's like closure to a really bad situation. But I don't think he was happy. I mean, David's heart, I mean, it's his son. No one's happy that his son gets murdered. The other thing is, I mean, yes, David longed for Absalom, but when you read the first verse of this, one place I was reading, they were saying that the term is used to describe he was still a bit angry with Absalom. So he might have been angry with him, but he still longed for him. You know, it's like God with us. I mean, he can be angry about the sin that we've committed, but he longs for us. And David is a type of Christ, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But he longs for him, but he's done something bad. And he also probably knows, which we'll talk about in a minute, that Absalom is not a good character. Like, if he brings him back, he knows Absalom hasn't learned his lesson. He knows that Absalom probably wants his kingdom. He knows that Absalom is just not a good guy. But he's still his son and he longs for him. So just a quick lesson here. Verse 14. The wise woman of Tekoa says, yet God does not take away life, but he devises means so that his banished ones are not expelled from him. And that's a lesson there for us. God does not seek to punish. God seeks to pardon. He does everything he can to pardon, just like David does in this setting. He's looking for an excuse to bring Absalom back. God is looking for an excuse to bring us back. Any excuse. Give him anything. Doesn't matter what it is. Give him just a little inch and he will bring you back. He's not there ready to condemn and to punish. He's there to bring you back. Even if you have to suffer some consequences, he's there to bring you back. Now, the other thing that this woman does to her credit is that she doesn't take the credit for this scheme. She knows David's happy now. She's finished. Like, she's gone through with it. David is clearly happy with the outcome. She could easily take the credit at this point. And if David doesn't like it, she could easily blame it on Joab. Right? That's what any normal person would do. But what she does is she gives the credit to Joab and says, Joab is the one who devised this clever scheme. And so what's the final outcome for this lady? I mean, Abuna Tadros comments on her, no doubt this woman deserves to be commended for her wisdom melded with humility by which she could get her heart wish, not for her own benefit, but for the sake of the peace of the congregation and to bring Absalom back to Jerusalem. So Abuna Tadros comments on this lady and says she deserves to be commended. Why? Because she does not live for herself. Not like Joab. She lives for the sake of other people. For who in this case? She did it for Joab. She did it for David. She did it for Absalom. She did it for the sake of the people. She did it for all these other people. Okay? She had nothing to gain from this. And it doesn't tell about any reward for her at the end of this. So there's no gain for her. But she does it anyway. She doesn't live for herself. Unfortunately, she's one step away from the ultimate step, which is living for God. Because living for the sake of other people, if done with honesty, can lead you to God. But it's not the be-all, end-all in and of itself. It's not the ultimate purpose. And there's lots of reasons for that. One, it might be that you're just unselfish in your nature, so there's no credit to you just because you happen to be unselfish. Two, who is to decide where your effort should and shouldn't go? For example, a soldier in a battle. Okay, he's left with a decision of the interests of the people that I'm protecting or the interests of those other people who are against us, or my platoon, or that person I'm about to kill. You know, so who is to decide? Now, of course, often it's obvious that you're just supposed to live selflessly, but often you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. So if that is your be-all, end-all, then you're going to get unstuck, and you're going to end up living selfishly. And ultimately, you end up living for yourself. If that is your ultimate goal, is to live for the sake of the people around me. That can't be your ultimate goal. That done with honesty will lead you to God. There's no doubt about it. But in and of itself will not lead to your commendation. Okay? And for example, if your role doesn't let you, your role may not let you live for the sake of the people around you. For example, David the king often did not have compassion on that person. He had to execute, you know, as king. So what's the highest level? What is the next step on that ladder? Is to live for God. That is the be-all, end-all. That is the final step. And that's the step that David's taken. Much more than Joab, who suffers a violent death, even much more than this lady, who is honorable. There's no doubt about it. She's an honorable lady, okay? But she's not at David's level, after the heart of God, who's a type of Christ, who's an inspiration just to read what they say about him. He's on a different level. So just a quick commentary on David, just quickly. How did they know that this plan was probably going to work? Like, what made Joab come up with this plan? He just knew the heart of David. He knew that David was a compassionate guy. He knew that if I make some sob story about someone that's going to lose their kid, then he'll crumble. He'll give in. He has to. It's just his nature. What does it say about us? Are we that approachable like David? Are we that compassionate like David? Do people say about us, if I come to him with a sob story, his heart will be broken? He's going to be broken for that person? That's what Christ is like. That's how Christ was. And that's how David was. That's why he's on a different level. And it's exactly why God approached David to condemn him of his sin through Nathan, through the same sob story. He went to him with a sob story. He said, there's a guy who stole the guy's sheep. It was his only sheep, and he killed it, and he ate it. Right? That's what he said. He said to him. And it was his only sheep. And this guy was rich, and he had heaps of sheep. And David says, well, that guy's going to die. That guy's going to die. Why? Because he's compassionate. Even though at that point in his life he was gone down some other road, he was a compassionate person. He was always striving for that. And then I said to you earlier, I mean, it doesn't count for you for anything if you're born unselfish and then you live your life majority unselfish because you're born that way. David, you could see that he, at some point in his life, lost his compassion completely. Completely. He killed Uriah. He made him die at his own hand. He couldn't care less about it. It shows that David, he valued it. And he constantly strove at it. He protected it in his own heart. And for a period, he lost it, but he got it back again. It wasn't necessarily just who he was. He worked at it all his life to please God. To please God. And then when Nathan comes and says, "You are the man who did this," he says, "I have sinned against the Lord my God." How often when we do something wrong, do we feel bad for the person that we wronged more than the person who is God? God who's told us not to do that, who we've put on the cross and done all these things to. We don't think like David does. We don't think, "I've wronged God." First and foremost. Of course, the love of the person next to you who you've wronged will lead you to God. There's no doubt about it. Okay? It will, if done with honesty. But the ultimate level is to always think of God, which is what David did. The other thing that we comment on David is that, we'll read in a minute if we have time, that David brings Absalom back, okay? And it's actually a very politically unwise decision. Why? He's made a mistake, according to all political commentaries. Even Matthew Henry rips David for being unwise. In fact, and I read this other commentary that said, look, it's all Joab's fault that Absalom came back. Why? Why is it so politically wrong that he did that?
It's like precedent now.
Maybe, yeah, precedent, but yeah, okay, but
Absalom makes a claim for the throne.
Exactly. Absalom comes back and he doesn't just make a claim for the throne. He sleeps with David's concubines. He totally turns on David. He does all these horrible things to David. Now, you wondered to yourself, did David have an insight that this might happen? Did David have an insight that this might happen to him? And I reckon he did. I don't think David was a fool. I think he understood his son and what his son stood for. When his son came back, which we'll comment in a minute, he didn't let him see his face for 2 years. He said, "No, he's not to see my face." And some people say that that's because he understood that if Absalom came too much into the castle and the kingdom, whatever, he's going to have a way in. So David was kind of protecting himself from Absalom. And also because he knew Absalom didn't learn his lesson. So he knew, but he took the road of compassion at his own expense. He took the road of Christ at his own expense. I think he knew. And I think even if he didn't know for sure Absalom will take my kingdom, he thought one way to the heart of Absalom is compassion on Absalom. If I'm going to turn Absalom around and make him not turn on me, maybe it's through compassion, not through a heavy hand, through a hard hand, like Absalom did. Absalom had a hard, heavy hand against Amnon. Whereas David has a compassionate, light hand. And he takes that road as opposed to the hard road. And there's another lesson there for us. If we stand at a point in our lives where we stand to be wronged, even if we perceive that we are going to be wronged, we're not like we think, "Oh, I'm as if this guy's going to pull one over me. He's not going to pull one over me." And then you combat it with violence, anger, distrust, something, you know, harsh words, angry words, by being deceiving back. Then you lose what David has, which is that God is on your side. God protects David's kingdom. David doesn't protect David's kingdom. If David tried to protect his own kingdom, he would have lost his kingdom. If he leaves it to God to protect his kingdom will be preserved. And so he chose, and he probably didn't think to himself so deeply about my kingdom and God will protect it if I just do this. All he did was act in compassion and love for Absalom. All he could see was, "I love this guy. I want him to come back to me. I'm going to act with love towards him." And that's how Christ acts. That's how Christ acts. Okay? And that's how we should act. Each day, our decisions should be made with compassion and love for the person in front of us, not worrying about the final consequence. Trusting that to God's hand. If God takes my kingdom, he takes my kingdom. If he takes my place, he takes my place. If he takes my money, he takes my money. If he takes my family, he takes my family. But I act in compassion and love for those around me, for the sake of God. And that's what David did. And that's why his kingdom, ultimately, through bloodshed, came out victorious. And Solomon had such a glorious kingdom because of David. And so often God says to Solomon, because of David, your father, that's why this happened. Because of David and because of my servant David. It's this attitude. He didn't care that his kingdom might be taken from him. And just another quick lesson from that point as well is that if we want to approach God for something, approach the way this woman approached David. Approach with humility. Approach with understanding that it's not my right. I'm requesting on your compassion, God. I appeal to your justice, but I also appeal to your compassion. If you want God to forgive you, bow down in front of him in fasting, compassion, in glory to God. Not in glory to myself and that this is not right what's being done to me, God. This is not right and you need to fix it. That's not how we approach God. If we want God to act with compassion, we approach like this woman approached David. And then the soft heart of God will turn in our favor, just like David did. It's 8:25. We'll just finish the chapter quickly. There's a fair bit to talk about with Absalom, but we've spoken about a lot of it already. Basically, just a quick summary is that Absalom comes back, and 2 years he's not allowed to see David. David says, not to see my face. And then Absalom calls Joab over and says, look. Oh, and they compliment Absalom. They say, there's a few interesting compliments. They're very unusual. They say that he was very good looking, which they do before. But they also say that his hair weighed a lot, right? Which is like, thank God that they condemn him about this because people like me, my hair weighs like a gram even if I grow an afro. Right? So that his hair weighed a lot and that he's extremely good looking. Okay, and had good looking children. Okay? But that's all the compliment that he gets. He gets no other compliment. Okay? All his value is that he's got some heavy hair and he's got a good looking face. That's it. And his hair weighs a lot. Honestly, that's what they say about him. Okay? And then he says to Joab, he says, look, if I'm going to be kept away from the king like this, he does a few things. He lights up Joab's farm. He says, Joab, why aren't you coming to see me? And he can't get Joab's attention, so he lights it up. Okay? Which is an extremely insulting thing to do. Okay? To light up someone's farm just because they don't want to speak to you. Okay? So he insults him. Joab comes to him and says, and he says to him, instead of apologizing, oh, sorry, I burnt your farm, I just couldn't get your attention. He says, you might as well kill me if you're going to leave me like this. Try and get my pardon from the king. Okay? And then David, he goes back to David and David accepts him and there's a full reconciliation between the two of them. Okay? The few just quick lessons about Absalom is that he does not learn his lesson at all. He still is extremely violent in his character. He's just proud. All he cares about is his looks. Why does Joab listen to Absalom when he just burnt his field? They say that maybe Joab, even in his violence, was afraid of Absalom because of how magnoon he was, all right? Because of his aggression. And that's another lesson, like I said with David, is that aggression or trying to get your way may get you your way. You know, doing anything you can to get your way, you will get your way. Absalom got his way. In fact, he almost got the kingdom. But you lose God. You get your way, but you lose God. That's the sacrifice. You either take God or you take what you want. You can't take both. Because then you have to leave it up to God. And Absalom lost God in the process completely. Okay? And then he ends up dying. How does he die? Does anyone know? I said before Joab kills him, but how did Joab get to him? By what? By his thick, heavy hair. That hair must have been so thick to be able to hold his whole body up. Right? And that held him up, and then Joab came and killed him. And that was by his hair. By the one thing that he was so proud of is one thing that killed him. And they think they used to lace their hair with gold powder. That's why it was so heavy. It was like something they used to do back then. It's weird. Okay, so just a quick lesson from him. I mean, there's a few lessons we can learn, but where's our value? Do we value our looks? Do we value our aggression? Do we value our way of getting things? Or do we value God? Do we put value in the things that cannot be corrupted? Like, you know, something I've learned these days a lot from my work is that a lot of people are depressed. And why are they depressed? It's because their value is in things that is by nature corruptible. Like their looks, their money. They commit suicide because they lose money. Or they get teased. Or they're not good looking enough. Or their husband leaves them because they're not pretty enough. Because their value is in this relationship. Their value is in my looks. The value is in my money. The value is in my power, my glory, my something. There's always value in something, and that's human nature. We value something to keep ourselves going in this world. And we are inherently going to lose all those things. By its very nature, we're going to lose everything. The one thing that we can hold on to is our humanity in Christ. That's the only thing that we can hold on to. Our humanity in God. And if that's the one thing you value, then that's the one thing that will keep you peaceful through everything. But the second that we all have our breaking point, why? Because we value something else. We all value something else. And then we need to break past that. And just a final lesson on Absalom is that we discussed last week that Absalom was not a punishment to David. Absalom was not a punishment to David. Absalom was a consequence of David. Absalom was David's son. Absalom saw what David did. In fact, probably the reason why they had to cop everything Absalom did to them and his filthy character and all the dirty things that he did was because David and Joab probably knew that Absalom knew about what David did and could expose him. Maybe that's one of the reasons. Or he would be a hypocrite to say, Absalom, how could you do this when I did this? Okay? So David would have been a hypocrite to act on Absalom. Okay? Because Absalom didn't really do much worse than David. Except for he never turned around. And the lesson for us here is that he was not a punishment. God didn't force him to do these things. Absalom had every chance to turn around and follow David's lead. David, yes, committed sin, but he turned around. Absalom had many years when David was good. He had 3 years in exile to turn around. He didn't. He had 2 years away from David's face. He didn't turn around. He had a few years in David's court. He didn't turn around. And then eventually he turned the whole kingdom on David. Okay? And then he met his final end. And we all have our chance. We all have our chance. Okay? So just a quick summary of today. There's three main characters that we talked about at the beginning. There's three ways of living in this world. There's living for yourself, okay, which we all have the option, but you lose God. There's living for the sake of others, which is a path to God, but not the be-all, end-all in itself. And there's living for God and being Christ-like like David. That's the ultimate way of living. That will guide every decision in your life. You will never be left with a difficult decision if that is your ultimate goal. And then there's a few lessons we can learn about Absalom. Okay, and then next week we'll talk about Absalom's treason and rebellion and all these things. Any questions? I'm running late, yeah.
Yes, sir. Practically, what's the difference in like living for God and living selflessly? Like it seems like it's the same
so,
behavior.
I mean, I'll tell you a story. I mean, yes, Christians live selflessly. Okay, those who live for God live selflessly. They go hand in hand. I mean, what are the two greatest commandments?
Love.
Love or two? I said one. Two. What are the two greatest commandments? Daniel, go.
Like, love your God with all your...
Yeah, and what's the second?
Love your neighbor.
Good. Love your God and love your neighbor. And when they come to Christ and say, what are the greatest commandments? He says, on these two hang all the law and the prophets. So he says, the whole Old Testament is based on these two things. So they are very intertwined. You cannot separate them. Okay? So Pope Benedict was... I read one of his books on Jesus. And what he said was that they go hand in hand. For saints, they are inseparable. But for humanitarians, they are very separable. Okay? So there are humanitarians out there where God is very separate to humanitarian work, living for the sake of others, or for the poor, or for the needy, or for the sick. But you might find in their personal lives, they are very morally imprehensible, whatever that word is. Okay? Because they're not living for God. God is holistic. Yes, when you're living God, they are inseparable. You cannot separate the two. And that's why I say it's a medium to God. But it's not the goal. The goal is God. And then you're able to serve properly. You're able to love properly. You're able to make proper decisions. And then the goal is achievable. You know, humanitarianism is not achievable. There's always someone poor out there. You try and help one sick person, there's 1,000 other sick people. You try and go to one nation for poverty, there's 1,000 other poor nations, you know. And you read the newspaper, I mean, your heart goes out to every nation in the world. I mean, we're always asked to donate to Egypt. But there's so many nations out there you want to donate to, but you can't. Because my goal is not just the sake of the other. It's the sake of the other through Christ. They're inseparable. And if I love God, And I feel like I don't need to do any form of humanitarian work, donation, loving, helping the poor, the sick, the needy. Then you're not really loving God. You're living for yourself. You have some other reason for doing it. And you'll notice that a lot of people that do humanitarian work is that it's for their own conscience. That's not the sake of why we work. We work for the sake of God, not to allay our own conscience. You know, Mother Teresa, she started the whole Sisters of Charity or some group that they did in Calcutta, in the depths of poor India, okay? And if you read her story, she says that, "I used to talk to God face to face. He was my beloved." And you should read it. It's as if she talked to him face to face. And then she goes, "I went 20 years, darkness, didn't see God, okay? Misery." And then she goes, "I got a small respite and then another period of misery." Okay? And you look at that, you wonder, what was that? Was it depression? Was that genuinely God leaving her? What was it? Of course, her conclusion is that I carry the cross of Christ. But you look at what she did, and she said, I couldn't smile. Like, I couldn't keep a smile on my face except for the sake of other people. I couldn't. So she wasn't doing it for herself. She wasn't allaying any sense of guilt. She lost that. Initially, maybe that's what it was. But she was doing it purely for the sake of God. Even if I can't feel God in my prayer, I'm doing it for your sake, God, and this is why I'm doing this. And so she gets into the depths of helping people. Okay? Not just for the sake of helping people. For the sake of her beloved. She writes, "Oh, my beloved asked me to do this. My beloved, my beloved, my beloved." It's almost like David says, I sinned against the Lord. He almost couldn't care less about Uriah. Not that he couldn't care less. It's that this is so much more significant to me. This is the be-all, end-all. And then because of that, I do all these other things. That's the difference. So in Christians, it's inseparable. In other people, it's very, very separable. In fact, most of the world is separating it out, saying, why do we need this Christian stuff? Why do we need that God? We can just be humanitarian. And you can see what's happening to the world. Any other questions? I think that's enough.